Well, why don't we go ahead and begin? We are in 1 Samuel chapter 21 this morning. We'll also cover a little bit of chapter 22 as well. We're going to focus on the priests of Nob. It's been a couple of weeks since we last talked, and so we'll give a recap of how we got here. David and Saul have had their final separation, where Saul has attempted to kill David. He's made it clear that he wants David dead. Jonathan has been loyal to David, and so he warned him about Saul's plans, and so David fled. And the last time David fled, he went to the city of prophets. And I think it's very interesting that this time he goes to the city of priests. Nob. David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And if you look in chapter 22, verse 19, you find out that Nob was a priest city. They all lived there. It is called Nob, the city of the priests. So we know that this is, there's more going on in Israel than is always told us explicitly in 1 Samuel. The prophets at Ramah have a whole operation that they're up to, and the priests at Nob have a whole operation as well. There's no temple at this point, and so and we don't know exactly how or why, but Nob is sort of the central sanctuary, at least where the tabernacle is. The tabernacle had been on the move, and you remember it was captured at one point and then sent back, but there was never a clear place for it to be. And that's a big part of what David wants to do when he becomes king, is resolve the situation of a central worship area. And so we get the idea that under Saul, there really wasn't any clear control over this. And perhaps some people were worshiping privately, or maybe there were rival centers of worship. And Nob somehow became the place where the Aaronic priests all congregated and stayed together, and they had charge of the tabernacle. Ahimelech is the leading priest at the time, but we see that his entire house is here. Of course, the priesthood was a familial line at this point. And there's some controversy, I don't want to spend time on it, but just so you know, Ahimelech and his son Abiathar, there's a lot of textual problems with figuring out which one is which sometimes. In Chronicles, their names seem to get reversed, and one gets called by the other's name, and there's another Ahimelech that appears, and so there's the question, are there two different Ahimelechs, or is it the same Ahimelech? And there's not really a consensus on how to resolve this, though the one thing that is always worth remembering is that officials, particularly kings and priests, often would retain the names of their fathers, and they would have two or three names. You see this with the Caesars, of course. And so that could always be the case, is that Ahimelech may have been a family name that get passed down. Not totally sure, and not a lot is riding on it, but if you do run across that, just know that Ahimelech is the leading priest, his son is Abiathar, but sometimes their names appear in other ways that make us wonder if maybe there are more than one of them, or maybe they both had the same name and were called by it, different names at different times. But Ahimelech is in charge of the tabernacle, and he is the one that David goes to. And he was afraid when he met David, and he said, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" The reason he's afraid is because everybody knows David is a member of the royal house. And so why is he by himself? And why is he over here with the priests? This is unusual. And David gives an answer that I think we can only say is a lie. He says, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send or I have commanded you. I have directed my young men to such and such a place.'" So David, he basically does not say, I'm on the run from the king, because probably Ahimelech would have said, well, get out of here. Don't come in here. That's going to be a problem. And David gives this excuse, and in the next chapter, he seems to take responsibility for what happens. You know, he says, it's my fault that everyone died, because his presence here causes them trouble, and he doesn't let them know what's going on. And so Ahimelech thinks, okay, well, if you're here on business, we'll receive you, whatever, we'll be hospitable. David says, give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found. And so what happens is that the priest gives him the showbread. This is sort of a famous story, more famous for its appearance in the New Testament than in the Old, but this is where it gets started. Now, later, when Ahimelech is in trouble, Doeg accuses Ahimelech of inquiring of the Lord for David. And this doesn't seem to be true. Nowhere are we told that Ahimelech did that. Ahimelech denies doing it. But we should know that that sort of thing did happen during the kingdom period. And in chapter 30, David actually goes to Abiathar, and instead of asking Abiathar to inquire of the Lord for him, he just does it himself. Chapter 30, verse 7, David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, bring the ephod to me, what the high priest would wear. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue the troops and overtake them? And this is worth knowing because, again, not everything is explained to us up front, but the priests had a function in Israel that they would have something of direct correspondence with God in a way that people did not normally have. The priest would intercede at the tabernacle, and the Urim and the Thurim are used sometimes. It's often very mysterious, but the picture we see is that they would often get special revelation from God. The priest would. And the kings would often inquire about this to make their decision, as you would if you knew this was going on. And so Ahimelech is accused of assisting David against Saul and using sort of special divine ordinances to do so. That's what the charge is. Ahimelech denies it, and nowhere are we told that it actually happened. And later, when David does want to do it, he just goes himself. He cuts right through, which is important because, as we'll see, David assumes priestly prerogatives here. And that's what's controversial about this situation. But it also shows David's special standing. And so David asked for food, and the priest says there is no common bread on hand. There's no ordinary bread. But there is holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women, they may eat it. Now, this qualifier is a little bit interesting because ordinarily you had to be a priest to eat the showbread, the holy bread. This was bread that went in the tabernacle. It was in the holy place. And so the priest is going to give an allowance here. Someone other than priests can eat it if they have kept themselves from women. Now, this means basically if they're not unclean. Uncleanliness happened a number of ways in the Old Testament. It was not the same as being in sin. And so any sexual intercourse would make you unclean. And the reason that he's asking this one is because these men look to be in a military company. That's the assumption. And it was the practice of Israel to men to be abstinent from sex during all war. And so that's the reason he singles that out, is he's assuming, okay, well, if y'all are in a war situation, they're probably going to be clean at least until they have to kill people. That's why he's asking that. This practice, it was practical. It reduced sort of war crimes, as you can imagine, are common with soldiers. But it also was a ritual cleanliness, because when Israel went to war, they were engaging in holy war to an extent. I mean, there was special holy war, and then there was just ordinary war. But at all times, the armies of Israel are called the armies of Yahweh. And so they're expected to be ritually clean during this time. And so the priest seems to be saying, if the men are clean, then I will let them eat this holy bread, even though ordinarily it wouldn't be proper. And so David answered the priest and said, truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. Other translations say the bread is common and the vessels consecrate it. So the argument would be that just like the men are ordinarily common, they have been consecrated because of their mission, or their bodies are consecrated because they're clean, just like the bread. The bread itself is nothing special, but it's been consecrated for a purpose. This is a nice lesson on what consecration means. Consecration does not mean that there's some sort of metaphysical, magical change in the substance, but it means it's been set apart for a job. Very important. And now when it's been set apart for a job, it is holy. You have to treat it with respect. It has to be handled properly. But that doesn't mean that it's not bread. I mean, it's still bread. And it can be deconsecrated after a while. So this is how it worked in Israel. This is why, as Protestants, we don't believe that the bread at the Lord's Supper turns into something else, even though it is very common in Protestant and particularly Presbyterian prayers to say, Lord, please set aside these elements from their ordinary use and dedicate them to your holy ordinance, something to that effect. You'll hear that a lot. It doesn't mean that they're being transformed into something other than what they are. It means they're being used for a holy purpose. And David says that's what we're being used for. Me and my men, we are being used for something holy. So that's why it's appropriate for us to eat the showbread. Now, you've all heard the story because Jesus invokes it to justify why he and his disciples are breaking the Sabbath. And it appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in each of those occurrences, the main story is the same. There are certain little details added. And the priests, or the Pharisees, get very upset at Jesus and his disciples. And we'll just read a little bit. Matthew 12. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And it's interesting here. A lot of times we explain this text, I think, a little too easily. We say, oh, well, it was an act of mercy. It was an act of necessity. And so it's no problem. But Jesus doesn't actually explain it that way, which I think is interesting. He says, have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him, when he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with them, but only for the priests. Have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are yet blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. If you had known what this means, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. And when Jesus says that, it's full of new covenant significance, because he's not only saying y'all are misunderstanding the Torah, though he is saying that. He's saying the Torah was meant to point you to something bigger than itself. It was supposed to direct you away from itself towards me, the Messiah. And so, in effect, Jesus is saying, we're not breaking the Sabbath, but the main reason we're not breaking the Sabbath is because I am Lord of the Sabbath. And all of the other explanations there are okay, they're not wrong, but they're secondary. You know, Jesus isn't saying, oh, you misunderstood, it was an ox in the ditch situation and we're okay. I mean, an ox in the ditch situation is a part of the law, but Jesus is saying more than that. You know, he's saying, I'm something special because of who I am, my mission, and the whole point of the law was to get you to me in my acts of mercy. And so he appeals to David for the purpose of saying, David did something similar. You know, David apparently transcended the limits of the law because of his special role and mission. And that's the way the argument goes. And so we look back at David and we have to really wrestle with this because would it have been permissible for David to do this? You know, that's sort of the question. Is this something that he just gets to claim? He just says, hey, I'm David. I get to do it. What's going on? And it is a little bit tricky here. Stuart?
This is a question. So when we say that Jesus is the Word, you know, I know he's, you say transcending the law, and sort he is sort of the embodiment of, he is the Word. We call it, refer to him the New Testament as the Word. But how does that work in? I mean, is he, since he is, he kind of, I know he's not just transcending it, but he kind of is the, he is the law and the Word. Is that, how does that?
Yeah, that's a good question. You always get that sense of dual Torah, right? There's the letter and the spirit. And so, in a sense, Jesus is the true and ultimate, you know, the most accurate presentation of the law. There's a way in which that's true. But he always makes that point sort of at the expense of a real sort of strict, wooden, inflexible adherence to just rule following. And so he's sort of saying you have to look deeper into what the law was teaching you. And so if you understood the law, you'd understand that mercy is better than sacrifice. And so what we're doing here is consistent with the intent. And that's the tricky thing, is that the intent of the law was always to allow for situations which might appear to be violations. And that's something we see a lot, even in the Old Testament, when we get into the situation of a godly lie or something like that. Or when we have the situation of God using Gentiles or even enemies of Israel to show his holiness and their sin. There's something that happens quite a bit in the Old Testament, that the message of the Torah sometimes comes out in ways that would make you think it was being violated or it's not working. And that's sort of the, I think that that's what's going on with this sense that the New Testament is explaining the Old Testament, but it's also, it's opening it up in a way that prior to that was always confusing. People weren't totally sure how to handle it. And so Paul says the mystery of the ages has been unfolded. The Old Testament was always sort of combustible, I think.
And but you can see how someone would say, well, like if you set some rules for your kids, and they say, well, we didn't obey the rules exactly, but we understood your intent,
yeah,
and we sought to uphold those. Now, you can get angry as a parent about that and say that wasn't right. But I think in Jesus' case, Jesus really is in a position to know the actual intent because he's in the Father at one. So, I mean,
Well, and I also think it's similar to what's going on here with David. David is not, he's not God incarnate, so he doesn't have all of the prerogatives of Jesus. But I do think he is claiming something similar. I mean, he is saying, we're consecrated because of me and who I am and the anointing put on me. And this is what's this is what's tricky about the situation at the tabernacle. He starts off apparently lying to Ahimelech, and he's later going to assume responsibility for the death of the priests. And then when he reasons with Ahimelech why it's okay, the argument is they are clean, so we're not going to profane the tabernacle. But he's also saying that they're sanctified. The men in his troop have been consecrated after a fashion. The vessels of the young men are holy. Now, that raises the question, you know, how, why, what makes them holy? And I think the simple answer is because David is the Lord's anointed. You know, he has been anointed and he is on a mission, and so these men are with him. There may be more that has happened that we're not explicitly told about that would consider them holy. I've read some articles that said that whenever you went to war in Israel, you assumed the holiness status. So these were warrior men. Some have even speculated whether or not they might have been Nazarites, but I think at this point we're just guessing. I mean, you know, we don't have any good reason to say, yes, they were Nazarites, but that it's possible. People could take Nazarite vows, and Nazarites were able to do priestly things. So that's possible. But David's argument runs that he and his men are holy. And they're holy in the same way that the bread is holy. Not in and of themselves, but because of the vessel, the thing that is around them, so to speak. The New Testament uses language of vessels, and I think that there's some help here we didn't know this completely, but in 1 Thessalonians 4, we are told to keep our vessels holy, to possess our vessels in a holy way. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 4. Each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. Sanctification means holiness. Same word. Not in the passion of lust, like the Gentiles who do not know God. And so, for David and his men to have holy vessels might mean that they've been anointed, they've gone through some ritual, but it may, and I think probably means, that they are carrying themselves in righteousness. They're on a holy mission. Which of the characters here is currently dominated by his lusts? It'd be Saul, right? The man who's in a rage of fury, throwing spears at David and his son. He's the one who's not holy. David and his men are holy, because, yes, they are not unclean, but also because of who David is and his mission. And I think there is a parallel here with Jesus' story in that sense. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the central point of all that Israel's been looking for. And in the Old Testament, David is that in miniature. He is anointed by the Lord. He is going to be the king. In fact, Jesus is the son of David. Jesus is the greater David. And so David is like Jesus in that sense, that because of who he is, his anointing and his mission, he is holy. And the work they're doing is the Lord's work. Now, it's still a little bit tricky. You know, if you really wanted to press this hard, you could go a long ways. I actually called up some friends of mine. What do you do with this text? And most of them say, well, that's one of those that we're always a little bit unsure where to land. But the point is that the intent of the law is always going to be God's purpose, God's redemptive plan. And so to use the law contrary to that is to misuse the law.
Mike just says that Jesus endorses it by putting mercy above ceremonial law. And I guess sort of like, what would we need to look for today so that we don't end up doing that?
I mean, we don't have ceremonial law, but I mean, is that anything that, like, we stand on principle when mercy is really what we need to be doing, or?
The weightier matters of the law are always love and mercy, and we see this particularly in the kingdom stories. I mean, Samuel is the one who says to Saul, it is better to obey than to sacrifice. And so there are lots of parallels here. I think that it's always a complicated question, right? When do you say, okay, this is a mercy situation, and we're going to do something that apparently looks like we're loosening other demands? But I think you have to ask the question, if my adherence to a seemingly ceremonial or external matters of protocol would in jeopardize someone, you know, in a missional way, right? It's gonna threaten their relationship with the people of God in an unjust fashion. It doesn't have to be this way. Could we allow something without being unjust in allowing it? I think those are questions to ask, because lots of times the answer is yes, right? I mean, it might be tough to make it through. We might be a little uncomfortable, but no evil has been done by allowing someone who hasn't quite got their act together to be around. but then there are lines in the sand. I mean, you can't allow someone who's doing evil to harm others and say, well, that's a mercy principle. You can't do that. And you can't allow someone to believe that evil is righteous and call that a mercy principle. So it's always complicated. It reminds me of the whole, you know, Doug Wilson's line, lower the standard. You know, there's a time when you lower the standard, absolutely. You have to know when and where, right? You have to be in charge of the situation to be able to understand that, because sometimes lowering the standard is bad. It's going to hurt people. And I think that's why it's a wisdom issue. Are you putting their spiritual well-being first? I think that would be the question. And so in a situation where permitting them to do something which feels like lowering the standard actually hurts their spiritual well-being, then that's no good. But if what you're doing is assisting them and getting them in a better place for spiritual health, then I think the principle holds. It is a complicated question. I mean, that's all part of it. And Jesus was accused of being too loose. Remember, the Pharisees said, this man is a drunkard. So we could ask the question, was Jesus of upstanding report in the community? And the answer would be, it depends on who you ask, right? There would have been people who said Jesus was living loose. And he says, if you wanted the guy who was really strict, that was John the Baptist. He was the one who fasted all the time, didn't have anything to do with impurity. Jesus jumps right into the mess. So, and I think that's why Jesus appeals to this, is because this is a tricky case. You know, if this were a real obvious, easy thing, then that wouldn't serve Jesus' purpose. His whole point is to say that the very strict, scrupulous adherence to every little thing misses the big picture. And that's not to say that the law doesn't matter. And if you're a priest, you did have to hold every little jot and tittle, absolutely. But when that's your primary concern over and against people's well-being, you know, people having food to eat, people being healed of sickness and disease, then something's going wrong here.
I think in verse 1 of chapter 12 of Matthew, it says they were going through the grain fields and his disciples were hungry. Mm-hmm. And when he starts talking about the Old Testament, it says, have you not read what David did when he was hungry? So, and then the very last verse 7 talks about, you know, I desire mercy more than sacrifice. So, I mean, I think it's fairly easy to understand that if there be any ceremonial law that we're to adhere to, or it carries over in some fashion, you know, mercy is the more important thing. That's just kind of the point.
Now, with David eating the showbread, he and his men are able to eat and be full. The priest gives it to them. But the problem arises when Doeg, the Edomite, spots them. Doeg was a servant of Saul, verse 7, chapter 21, the chief of the herdsmen. Now, we have to remember in ancient times, those titles, chief of the herdsmen, did not mean he was just a herdsman. He was the guy in charge of the whole cattle industry. That's what that means. And we're going to find out he was something of an officer. Doeg is an important person. And so he spots David, and he knows that David is a fugitive. And so he's going to go rat him out. We see in chapter 22, verse 9, Doeg was set over the servants of Saul. So he's a high manager. He's in charge of lots of things. And when he sees that David and his men are there, he goes directly to Saul to tell him what's going on. And now David asks for a weapon right away. And we find out that David spots Doeg as well. And he knows that trouble is coming. One of the interesting things, of course, is the weapon that David is given. The priest said, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod." And so again, there's all this interesting material that we're not told a lot about. Why was the sword here? How did it get here? What were they doing with it? But one thing is clear, they had put the sword in the tabernacle. It had a religious significance. It's some sort of special, I don't know if relic is the right word, that might imply too much connotation, but they memorialized it and they put it in the tabernacle. The same thing happens with the bronze serpent. And of course the bronze serpent becomes an idol and gets smashed, so we know that it's possible for holy things to become idols. But it's interesting that there it is, the sword of Goliath. And so David says, "Give it to me." And it does make you wonder, then, is David using the sword in all of his future battles? You know, the Bible doesn't draw a lot of attention to it, doesn't give any extra commentary, but I think it's possible. David says, "There's none like it. This is a special sword. And so, give it to me." And he arose and he fled. Is David wielding the sword of Goliath? That's kind of a cool idea, right? I don't know that he keeps it forever or what he does with it, but it's in here. It's one of those interesting little blips. And you go, what's that all about? Now, David goes straight to the Philistines. This is what's interesting. He goes to Achish, the king of Gath, but Achish is suspicious, rightfully so, and so David feigns insanity. We'll talk about this next time. There's a whole psalm about this experience. But David, again, deceiving people, pretending to be crazy so that he can make an escape. And then he goes to the cave of Adullam. We'll come back to David. I want to talk about now what happens to the priests. Doeg goes to Saul and tells him what's going on. Now, Saul is at Ramah, which is interesting because what is Ramah? Place they went last time. It's where Samuel and the prophets are. And the first time David fled, that's where he went. Saul went after him and he, you know, falls down in this frenzied state, having to prophesy against his will. So Saul goes back there because he assumes that must be where David has gone. And so Doeg knows to find Saul there. Saul is clearly upset at perceived treachery. You can hear him just sort of spouting out anxiety in every direction. "Hear now, you Benjamites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait." So Saul is still very angry about Jonathan. He's accusing all of the people of being treacherous and hiding this information from him. So we get the idea that Saul is really, he's going crazy at this point. You know, he sees conspiracies everywhere. He's on edge. And Doeg, the Edomite, I think that that's important. He's not an Israelite. He's an Edomite, descendant of Esau. He says, "I know where David is. He is at Nob. he inquired of the Lord, or he asked Ahimelech to inquire of the Lord for him. And he gave him provisions, and he gave him the sword of Goliath. And so what this means is basically Ahimelech has assisted your enemy. He's given him special information and weapons. And so we should go punish him. And so the king goes to Ahimelech and all of his father's house and all of the priests who were in Nob. And Saul says, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, Lord. Why have you conspired against me? You are the son of Jesse. You have given him bread and a sword and inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Now Ahimelech answers in such a way that he doesn't know that Saul and David are enemies. And we need to understand that this is completely possible that he has not heard yet. David fled, he ran away, he went straight there, and so Ahimelech would not have had any way to know. And he says, "Who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? You know, I thought David was a good guy. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me." No way. "Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all of this, neither little nor much." And I think Ahimelech is telling the truth. He wouldn't have known. And so he says, "I don't know what you're talking about." But the king says, "You shall surely die, you and all your father's house." Now, this is really bad because, first of all, it's bad to kill a whole family. That's not okay. But this is killing all the priests. I mean, that's what this statement says. "You and all your father's house, I'm going to wipe you guys out." Now, there could have been priests from other lines at this point, but still, it's a big deal to kill an entire house of priests. And it would have appeared to be blasphemous, which is why the king's men refused to do it. Saul says, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David." But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. And so the army here is not, they're not going to do it. I mean, this is asking them to violate their conscience, to go against Yahweh. And so they don't. And the king said then to Doeg, "You turn and kill the priests." And he does. Now, perhaps Doeg doesn't feel the same constraints, being an Edomite. He's not an Israelite. Or perhaps he's just a really bad dude. Which, you know, probably the answer is both. Because we see that not only does he kill the priests, 85 of them, but he also kills their wives, their children, their nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, and sheep. He annihilates the whole city. Now, why would you do this? What does this mean symbolically? To kill man, women, children, and beast?
In the name of God.
Yes, this is a holy war punishment. This is what they were supposed to do to the Canaanites.
But they didn't.
You are enemies of Yahweh. And so you can see the level here, that Saul is basically identifying himself exclusively with Yahweh, and anyone who opposes him is an enemy of Yahweh. And so this would be a great blasphemy, a great evil, but also an abomination to defile the tabernacle. I mean, just think, if possibly eating the showbread is going to defile the tabernacle, how about killing all the priests, their wives, children, and animals? This is bad stuff. Only one escaped, Abiathar. And Abiathar is going to go to David and will become a king. I mean, become a priest later. What's interesting, and I don't know how much we can defend this, but the rabbinic tradition says that all of the priests being killed is a fulfillment of the judgment on Eli. When Yahweh said that his sons would die, that it implied not just the two sons, but all of them. And so this would be a culmination of that judgment, all of Eli's house being destroyed. Of course, the other parallel is that almost all of David's house is going to be destroyed as well. And David actually takes responsibility for what happens here. Verse 22, David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house.'" And so David, even though he is in the right, he takes responsibility for what has happened. He says, "This is on me. I did this. I brought this about." And he tells Abiathar, "Stay with me, and I will protect you." Now flip to Psalm 52 now. I think this is always interesting when we can cross-reference. Psalm 52 is what David wrote about this event, Doeg killing the priests. We're told that in the inscription, "To the chief musician, a contemplation of David, when Doeg the Edomite went and told Saul, and told him, 'David has gone to the house of Ahimelech.'" And of course, it isn't simply that he told him, but it's what happens afterwards. And here's Psalm 52. "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. You love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, 'Here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever. I will praise you forever, and in the presence of your saints," or holy ones, "I will wait on your name, for it is good." So David is both cursing Doeg, and he is professing faith that God is going to make this right. "I will wait on your name, for it is good." And so David himself is not taking vengeance at this time, but he is giving vengeance to the Lord. And he does expect God to destroy Doeg. This is an imprecatory psalm. We have to be very careful with imprecatory psalms. I've known people who were very quick to bring them out against anybody they were angry with. And obviously that is not what they are for. But they have a use for the Christian. Imprecatory psalms are appropriate even today. I think what we learn is that they are used against the powerful, mighty men who boast in evil. You don't use them against someone who is sort of already broken and in sin, but not knowing what to do and mostly hurting themselves. It's those mighty men who are hurting those weaker and those who are working against the Lord, going against God himself. And we oppose them, not of ourselves, but through God, our prayers and our trusting in the Lord to write this.
Do we know if he's talking about Saul or Doeg? Does it equally apply to both?
Yes, I think both is probably the answer here. Mighty man is a term that often means nobility, so both would qualify. And I think that both are responsible for this. Obviously, Doeg does it, but Saul gives the command.
Right. He didn't actually say, and the things he's accused of is deceitful, tongue devises destruction, loving evil rather than speaking righteousness and devouring words, sinful tongues. It doesn't even talk about the murder of the priests that I can see. So,
well, we know David had a lot of that because of the, you know, it's about that because of the preface.
Yeah, the preface tells us. Right. So, yeah, I think he's using that in such a way to show us that it's the motivation that led to the action. And, of course, this would apply to anyone who is similarly driven by this motivation towards acts of evil. So it isn't like, well, you can only use this if someone killed all the priests, right? It's against people who allow their evil to devise the destruction of others. But it's a good point. It could be about both. David does sort of keep a sort of loyalty to Saul throughout, which is one of the challenges of the David-Saul narrative. When Saul dies, David cries about it, and he seems really broken about it. And I can't imagine him being broken about the news of Doeg dying. And so there's a little bit different with his relationship with Saul, but I think Saul is involved here, absolutely. Has to be implicated.
And, I mean, you know, David does continue to honor the office at least that.
Oh, yeah. The whole time. Absolutely.
And won't kill him, even though he had the opportunity. So
right.
And says, I will wait on your name. Mm-hmm. Like he's being patient, waiting for
absolutely.
God to
and I think that is the main point of Psalm 52, is that David didn't try to take justice into his own hands. He didn't avenge himself, as Paul says in the New Testament, but he gave vengeance to God. When we say vengeance is the Lord's, sometimes people say that with the assumption that, well, no vengeance will happen, right? Just we shouldn't judge. But really that means you're giving God the vengeance. He's going to be the one that does it, and he will. And so David is waiting on the Lord to do that. Notice, though, what it is that makes the mighty man so evil. Yes, he does devise destruction. He does love lying and deceit. But verse 7 really tells us the heart of it all, doesn't it? He doesn't make God his strength. He trusts in the abundance of his riches and strengthens himself in his wickedness. So the evil man strengthens himself by continuing to do evil, make himself bigger and badder. Think of Tubal Cain, right? If Cain is avenged 7 times, I will be avenged 70 times 7. And so the evil man does not look to the Lord for his strength, but rather doubles down with his own force and evil desires. And that is what Doeg and Saul are both involved in. This point. All right, we will conclude here and pick it up again maybe next week if it's possible, Lord willing, and the situation doesn't change with or if the baby comes soon enough. We'll be here again next week. If not, we'll have a sub. So let's close with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, we do thank you for your goodness and that you are our strength. We ask that you would bless us, that we would learn from your servant David, and that we would understand the truths that are even difficult at times, that mercy is greater than sacrifice, that your Son is Lord of the Sabbath, and that he comes to give us rest, to heal, to feed. We pray that you would direct us, that we would love mercy, and that we would follow that example. And guard our hearts, that we would not become full of anger or vengeance, that we would not become evil men who strengthen ourselves, but that we would rather wait on you, for your name is good. We do ask that you would put down those workers of evil. Use your servants to protect those in need. We pray that your Son, King Jesus, would defend us, glorify your name forever. Amen.